When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
The Sovs or the Russians, if equipment didn't work, like a tank ground or something, they would just throw it out the top and then not bother to recover it straight away. So again, this was gone dust for us.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list to keep up with the latest episode. In October of 2022, I was asked by the West Pennines Military Vehicle Trust to moderate a question and answer session with a number of Bricksmith veterans. Attending were drivers Neil Walton, Pete Curran, Dave Collins and Kev Smith, plus Sandy Saxton Warne, Joint Operations and Weapons, Mike Hill, Tour Officer, Mike Corcoran, Weapons, and Dave Butler, Senior Tour Officer. It was an amazing afternoon of reminiscing about their experiences and viewing the amazing collections they had from that time. My good friend Colin Deiter helped with the complex recording of this session, but a quick note that the audio is not up to the usual quality of Cold War Conversations due to background noise, but I think the events and activities described definitely make it worth listening to. Thank you. The Cold War Conversation continues in our vibrant Facebook discussion group and on Twitter. Just search for Cold War Conversations on Facebook and we're at Cold War Pod on Twitter. Now, Cold War history is disappearing, but a simple monthly donation will help keep this podcast on the air. You'll be part of our community, you'll get a sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history.
Hi, I'm Abe Brandt, and I support the Cold War Conversations podcast financially, quite simply because it's the best history podcast out there, and I want to make sure it continues. Keep going, Ian, and thank you.
If a monthly contribution is not your cup of tea, we also welcome one-off donations via coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome 7 Bricksmith veterans to our Cold War conversation.
Out of the area, with the imagery, very excited, got on the phone, which we could do. We could call the mission house and pass on information. I told them, We thought we had something interesting. Anyway, come back, photographs are on the desk, debriefing, we got SS-21. And it wasn't for a couple of days that somebody looked at them again and said, but hang on, SS-21 has 3 axles, this has 4. And we realized we actually had a brand new equipment seen for the first time in East Germany. So there's a bit of a danger to keeping information quiet. We were an experienced crew, but you know, that business of expectancy, where you think you know what you're seeing, can sometimes come back and bite you in the ass. Now, there's a follow-on to this story. The photo interpreters and photogrammetrists were very excited about the imagery. And we actually got color imagery, which was even better, because color had not long been in the mission. And their only concern was, well, you know, you've got a succession of pictures, you have the water drive going and so on, But, you know, what we really need to be certain about performing fully gravimetric work on this to get its dimensions is for somebody to go back and measure a couple of known objects. And there happened to be a broken tree in the picture, which they said, if you could just go back and get the measurement between that tree and this one, we'd be delighted. So a week later, the same crew went back, and the area was still occupied, not to the same extent. But we went in very cautiously and got those measurements, and to our delight, I think 2 or 3 months later, Jarek actually sent us the model they had made from the imagery and the measurements to show off the equipment. And Mike will remember this very well. And that's that story. But the images are available.
I like to think of what made us go and measure the distance between two trees.
It was a very tense moment getting out of the vehicle up in that area to go and make the measurement, I can tell you.
You mentioned a couple of interesting things there, because in passing you said, of course, they were taking markings off vehicles and things like that. And those were actually tremendously important in several different ways. First of all, was the big mark, the side number. And that is what was giving you the ORPAD, and to a lesser extent, the TOE, the Tables Organization Equipment, of what the Russians were. Was it 30, was it 33 vehicles, the battalion, things like that. But actually, sometimes total stencil numbers on the side were equally important, because that would give you production numbers. You would have an idea of when it was made, how many of them were made, and you would build that picture up over 23 years, sometimes 10, 15 years, and you would actually get good ideas on how many SS-21s, SS-23s, EMV-2s had actually been made when they started producing. And of course, Jarek was stealing a lot of this kit at different locations, but on relatively fuzzy imagery. And there was no way they could get site numbers and production markers and big reliability. The other thing we used to push those through our regular maturity, push them for, was stereo imagery. So we would say to someone, couldn't you just move a couple of feet to one side and then take another telegram? And I mentioned the water drying, of course, it was great. And stereo imagery made such a difference to the quality. You get things like the depth of the crew arches out of it. And one of the big things, tremendously important, but physically quite small, that came out following, I think it may have been T80, was a tiny little arch about 4 inches across on the top of the front deck, just off to the siding glass. And that we knew and we were expecting was going to be a GLONASS terminal. From the Russian GPS system, which is called GLONASS. We'd never really seen it. And it was only once they got stereo imagery they could actually pick this thing out. We knew it was there because we were hearing the broadcasts through some of our colleagues that were working in other places. But we'd never actually seen it fitted to any equivalent setting. And of course, now GPS is common. Another simple one that came out of that is late topology. Was on various train sightings we had been seeing as the tank battalions, it's more to write for the bridge up to tank battalions. And it was always six, usually empty wells, sometimes slight failure in some lines. And then a couple of command vehicles, then another six. And of course, 18 of those would make up battalion. And looking at the stereo imagery of these Arctic you could see that one of them, in every six, had something unusual on it. The tank was a very slightly different shape. And eventually we decided, we've got to figure out what this is. Obviously something under there. It's not just the way that the iron that before we put it on the top of the equipment. And somebody on one of the trains managed to cut through the canvas on with correct guff. Yet photographs of it in the dark. Couldn't really see what they were photographing themselves. Brought it back and said, we got that thing in the last 4 years. But it turned out he was a laser rangefinder. And this isn't the days again when laser rangefinders were relatively new. But of course, the difference that that makes to an anti-tank battery retaliator's grog is that suddenly, very accurately, they can tell how far away in opposition's tanks are. So that made a huge equipment difference to what the Russians had. For something that was only a few inches long, really. Really quite important. The sparing of imagery, taking imagery covertly, things like that, is hugely important. And yet we're all actually quite physically small bits of care.
And I think it's worth mentioning that stereo capture was taught on the special duties course that everybody attended. It wasn't all to the forefront of your mind, you're quite right, Mike. But you've touched on GPS, and in the mid to late 80s, we'd be through the Gulf War and so on, and GPS had been issued at limited numbers. It was not carried routinely in the mission. And in my time, 86, 89, only a few GPS units began to come in, and they were generally issued, I think, to the Air Force tours, who wanted to be certain of their positions when they were assessing certain aerial tactics. And it was a very sensitive equipment. You know, nobody wanted to be known that we had them, because before that, and I think mentioned the trip counters, you know, and the fact that you were driving very much like a rally driver in many instances. The vehicles had no benefit of satellite navigation in the way that we do today. We take for granted. So, you know, the counter in the vehicle was not the one you see today on your dashboard. It was actually a rally counter down to, I think, a 1 meter accuracy. And on visits to prepare for working tours, people would actually use these to gain very accurate measurements of distances between intersections, for example, so that at night, when light night imaging was poor and so on, you could use the distances traveled between particular junctions to tremendous effect to put yourself in the right position. And you know, that was the case as much for finding your sleeping places as anything else. But it was occasionally tactically useful too.
Yeah. Again, talking of sensitivity, and it really goes back to the thermal imager, if you remember, Mike. Yeah, it was back then in the late 80s, it was state of the art. And I remember John Farrin saying to me on one occasion, I'm not sure who the tour officer was, we were going out to do some thermal imagery, and he said to me, on no account must this equipment fall into enemy hands. I don't care what you have to do to it, you know, but you must make sure that if you think you're going to be taken, you need to destroy it so that we don't give the opposition, you know, the chance to get it back. So, it's the Armored Corps guy, you know, on the team. You know, I know only too well how important it was as a tank gunner. You know, I was one of those in the early days, you know, to be able to recognise so we didn't get the blue on blue, you know, and
I remember having that conversation with you, Dave, in a vehicle, in a tour vehicle.
Yeah, it was good stuff, you know. And of course, we did it, you know, the beauty of TI, of course, was you could do it in the dark as well as in daylight as well. And you just need to see the kit, you know, through the NVGs and then get the thermal. And the technique I used to use, of course, Mike, was not wind the windows down, but open the top hatch, then go out the spot. So at least if you were going to be attacked, you had a chance. Before the saw, yeah, I'm sorry.
Had to reach out for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But from the sublime and thermal imaging, can we take it back to the slightly ridiculous? And it's not, because Mike Corker would be horrified to hear me say that, but I don't know whether anybody's mentioned yet the Box Bunny guys. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. The public would think it just crazy. That you spend an awful lot of time and effort identifying particular types of cargo, well, not cargo, but the working vehicles, military vehicles. And we actually had in the mission a thing called the Box Body Guide, which had attempted, at least I think, probably succeeded, in identifying every possible combination of box sizes. And by box, I mean like a panel van with chamfers and bumps and lumps and the number of windows, the number of doors that the vehicle it sat on. They all were given, I think it was a 5-figure designator. Yeah, became 5 eventually. Well, I mean, a lot of people might have heard the old aircraft recognition thing, left, wings, engine, fuselage, and tail. Well, the box-body guide was the same thing for box-bodied vehicles. And, of course, it was immensely important because some box bodies had very, very important connotations. The 10 a penny were the sort of commandants, military police vehicles, which were the blue lights with button-down columns. But if you saw a box-body vehicle, a very rare one, which was associated with missile command or strategic communications, that was a horse of a different color. And, these things were all, all the extraordinary details were incredibly important.
And it really came into its own. Towards the end of the mission, the Russians were introducing, the Russians were introducing lots of brand new equipment. Most of them looking fairly good on the surface. And back in the late 70s, when I was at Six Company, our tech drawing section there in development, what became known as the Workbody Guide. And to show the forethought in the eyes, when these new Russian vehicles came in, the Copper Series, Copper Road, which were fairly enormous, and I think certainly 3 axles, possibly more, I haven't ever heard of one. But in fact, they slotted right in the right place in the box body guides. And you could identify fairly quickly what they were for. There's things like Air Defense Command Force and such, like Division Command Force, stuff like that, right up to Army rank. And we eventually, I mean, the people down at Six Company had to eventually issue a whole new series of box body books covering the Copper Series. But the readout system for them was exactly the same. And of course, because the Russians exported those equipments all over the world, particularly to the Middle East, but also to places like India and such like, those guys became pretty much de rigueur in most embassies if you wanted to start identifying what equipment was. And certainly I did an embassy tour, and the embassy I had been in, although it wasn't Russian equipment, we used exactly the same guide for the box body system and completely identifying on it. And it was an example of how something that started off relatively simple suddenly became hugely enforcing, really, really useful. The detail of intelligence should you guys get.
Cool, okay, I think on the intelligence side as well, the PI pictures were taken of exercise areas. Didn't you used to send people in to take mouldings as well on the tyres? Tyres on in the sites as well, and they could work out the size and the weight of the vehicle and things like that as well.
So we'll just put the gravity on. I never actually took any of those myself. Maybe Mike or Dave did.
I think it's
more about stealing anything you could get that.
Yeah.
they always wanted hard evidence of a lot of stuff. So where you could, you just got you brought back. We came back in the office,
I think
I don't think it involved Dave or myself or any of you, but I think not many years before I'd got to the mission, somebody picked up a piece of what was almost certainly ammunition on a range and brought it back to the mission and caused complete chaos because the thing was live. And you can imagine, you got it in the mission offices back in West Berlin, and it's pretty sensitive in all probability, but you've got to get in the EOD guys to look at it. So, suddenly you've got to talk about clearing around and finding one who's reliable and all the rest. Before it goes bang, it's all interesting stuff.
I have a happy memory of that because when I arrived, the late 80s, mid to late 80s, I went into the weapons office and there was this pile of stuff underneath a small tarpaulin. in one corner, and I said to my predecessor, what's that? And he says, oh, it's just junk that the guy's brought my Umbro period, you know. Bear in mind that even in the weapons office, we would go up to it and pick up junk ourselves occasionally. And after I'd been in there a couple of months, I thought, I should really have a look underneath that and see what's there. And most of the stuff I did, yeah, stamped on it. And I say most, and that was the thing that was a little bit worrying. And we thought, take Mike's advice there. We'll get an ATOR and have a look at this. And you did actually clear most of Berlin Block for about 2 days. And it was more embarrassing than anything else. And one or two bits of it were actually taken back out into East Germany and dumped there again. Well, it's a little easier.
Hey, Mike, you know, remember this?
Was that reactive arm? It's reactive armour on the side of the turret.
I think that would be, it won't call in question time, but just to give this an intro, I had every intention of doing this because I thought, even being in Brixmas myself, I wasn't on that tour with Dave at the time. Yeah, and it's quite a sort of...
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Famous incident within Brixmas at the time where these little boxes started to appear on tanks. And I'm not going to steal Dave's thunder, but I think it's worthy of mention, the old story as to how Dave actually come to collect one of those boxes. So off you go, Dave.
I think more the question is to everybody is why have I still got one?
Yeah,
exactly. I got that at the end, but no, you're right. It was 1987, and we got tasking through various channels to try and get hold of an explosion reactive olive box off of a T-80. I think I'm right in saying, Mike, and you might. Is the Americans already got one of a T-64 Bravo. We weren't sure at the time whether it was the same boxes or whatever. And so we were tasked with getting an explosive reactor or an ERA box off a T-80, which was the latest tank to be introduced into East Germany. So, again, as the Armoured Corps guy, I was given the task of putting together a plan. And so... the first idea we came up with was most of the exercise went on in what we call the permanently restricted areas, or PRA, where we weren't allowed to go officially. But in order for the tanks to like get back to their bases when they'd been on the training areas, they had to come out. And one in particular ramp was on the side of the Letzlinger Heide, where the actual ramp, where they all got onto the floor, go back to their units, was in at this particular base. And we knew the T-80s were in there. And so so the plan was that when they all got on their flatbeds, the tanks, we would climb on the train as it was pulling out and steal one of these boxes off the side. Now, that sounds fairly easy when you say it quickly, but of course, because of the things we didn't know. We didn't know, for instance, that each one of these boxes is held on by two nuts. And so we weren't sure what the size of the nut was. And so what we didn't want to do was get on the flatbed and find that we couldn't actually get the thing off because we didn't know the nut size. So we went down in a pot stand and found a spanner from an East German shop which had four different nut size measurements on it. And I think we'd done some close-up photography, and we had an idea what it was, but we didn't really know. So I had the spanner, and the idea was, so we're going to climb on the train. Our vehicle was going to leave where we were and go up the road about 10 kilometres. We would work on getting the box off, and then as it came round another bend, the train, we would jump off, get back on the vehicle. That was the plan. And we even practised it, not getting on the train, but going into PRA on this particular bend, where we knew the train would have to slow down a bit and get on. So that was fine. Then, subsequently, about a few days later, I was up in a place called the Lieberman Tank Range, up over on the, I think it was a Polish border,
and we're in the east of East Germany, I was watching T-80 firing on the moon on a Ranger. So we watched it all day, and then at night, when they finished, as usual, the tanks would pull off the range and go back to our homing area. And our SOP, standard operational procedure, was always to go onto the range and just scavenge for whatever we could find, whether it was letters they'd written home and they'd gone to the toilet and wiped their bombs on it, right through to any munitions. For some curious reason, the Sovs or the Russians, if equipment didn't work, like a tank ground or something, they would just throw it out the top and then not bother to recover it straight away. So again, this was gold dust for us. Anyway, we went on to the firing area after they'd all left, and I was just walking along through these tank pits where they were, and I saw sticking out of it, out of the sand, just a little fracture of polar and green stuff. And so I bent down and I picked it up, and as I did, I pulled one of these out of the sand. And we subsequently concluded that what happened was, as the T-80 fallen into the firing area, the vibration of the tank firing there had loosened one of the nuts. And in fact, one of these has like a curve in it, and the other one is a complete nut. And so what happened is it shook off the tank, fallen on the ground, and as the tank backed out of the tank pit, it had pushed it into the sand, luckily it was soft sand. So the thing was almost intact. More importantly, so I knew what I would found. It was a bit like winning the lottery. Suddenly I heard all this music around me. There wasn't any music, but I knew I had it. I put it in my East Sherman stack and just strolled back to the vehicle. And the tour officer, bless him, he's dead now, and the driver, who's still alive. So we went off then to a rail crossing, which we'd always do, have a cup of tea and just talk about what we found and all the rest of it. And I had my stack in the front of the car, and I kept the ERN box in the bottom of it, and I think the tour officer had found some ammunition, and I went, look at that. Anyway, and I just said, oh, by the way, I think I've got an ERN box. And I pulled it out, but you can imagine in the vehicle, it was like, I won't swear too much on air, but it was colourful, let's just say that. And the tour officer said, well, we've got to go straight back to this because this is like the find of the century. And I said, no, because we knew the narcs or the secret police were following us. I said, we don't want to do anything out of the unusual. And also, we had I don't know if you mentioned Tom Hall yet, but we had a dance to do that night. And I was particularly keen to do dumps for some reason. And so I said, no, we'll just stay out for the next 2 days and then go back and hand it in. So we did that, we went back. And I think we got back on a Friday night. It was one of my best mates leaving dudes, and we were all in the club, and the brigadier was in there, John Foley and that. And I think I said, Mike, were you the tech guy? You and Mark Weldon, wasn't it, I think? Anyway.
Ian Passing.
Oh, Ian Passing, yeah. And I remember, and I said to the other two, when we went up to handing out our booty that we found, I said, look, let's just make let's get some humour out of this. So we'll go in, we'll put all our other stuff on the counter, I'll keep the ERA box in the sack, then as we'll turn to walk out, and I'll go, oh, by the way, I've got an ERA box. And put that. I just remember, Mike, the look on your face and the rest of it. And I think actually, by the time we got to the club for the farewell drinks for Bromley, I think you'd already rang John Foley at Tom, because he got me to one side and said, well done, Dave, that's brilliant. And I think, so, in terms of intelligence, I think he was a fairly momentous one in 1987. I was very lucky and privileged. And the GOC, the General Officer Command in that time in Berlin, was a guy called Patrick Brooking, who was a 5th Royal Enniskillen Dragoon Guard, which was my regiment. And he used to get a monthly briefing, I think, from the mission, didn't he? And I remember him saying to me in no uncertain terms that he was so proud. And years afterwards, he said to me, Dave, I dined out on that story of my man from my regiment getting the ERA box off the T-80. He said, just a wonderful thing. And I must admit, looking at Ukraine over the last 6 or 7 months, I've been drooling at the map.
than going out there with my spanner. They got it. 38 years later, I was driven at the Defence Academy there, and they got a T-62 ERA. They got off the Coleman Rates or something. Anyway, I went there because when I made the film about Rick Smith, I wanted an ERA box. So I went down there, and they said, "Well, you can have one balance day." So I said, "Well, can I try my spanner?" So after 30-odd years later, I found out that the spanner we got would have worked had we had to use plan A. So it was all very neatly tied up. But anyway, that's the story, guys.
Good story.
And they presented me with this and said, "You might as well keep this." I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it, but it's too heavy to put on the wall. But they are quite heavy.
What was that?
This one, yeah. The idea. Actually, when they got this back to him, I think it was, I got on the Friday, and it was back in the diplomatic bag on the Saturday morning, I think. And when they took it apart at Malvern, or whatever it was, they found out that actually it tripled the thickness of the armour of the T-80 tank because of the exploded plates inside. And so the West End went completely into warp speed to develop a tandem warhead. And I think, if I'm right, you know, part of that result was the Javelin that's now having so much success in Ukraine because it's got the tandem warhead on it. One knocks the box off and the other, the subsequent bolt then goes through. So every time I see the SOT tank knocked out in Ukraine, I do take some small gratification from the, I might set the ball rolling with this. Anyway. That's it, guys.
Brilliant story. It's good, though. That Operation Tomahawk that Clay's on about there as well was the rubbish dump one. So there was one at Beelit Estate there that I remember going to with two of the boys. And it's night vision goal. We should go in really early in the morning. And Beelit was a hospital, wasn't it? And the lads were in, the SOCs were in Afghan at the time. And so they were shipping back there injured to Beelit Hospital. And so one night we were out there, and it's our job as a tour driver to watch for security as well while the guys are out doing their stuff. So I'm looking around for the NVGs, and this arm was thrown on the front of the G-Wacker. It's turned off. I'm like, "Oh, what was that?" And these two guys who remain nameless, like, they're laughing at special people. And they're laughing their head off at that crack of visibility out. Kev was saying, you know, they had the rubber boots and the gloves. I've got a pair of them gloves. I haven't bought a pair today. Yeah. So I've got those gloves, and that was because there were so many needles and everything in the rubbish dump that they were getting. And it was infected and everything, wasn't it? Porky. And then at the end, while we were there, Philip became Joint Intelligence Service. They kind of told us, that the chief says, "Right, now you can go on a cultural tour and you can borrow a camera if you like. But if you get caught, then you're on your own." Sort of thing. You know, so straight down to Magdeburg I was, looking for SA-12. Well, my fight, I have to admit, I ran out of fuel as well, and my wife and the pregnant wife in the car, which wasn't a good thing for a British operator to do. Should have filled up in Berlin before it went. Only a half a K down the road, but I had a bit of a walk. So, yeah, it was quite fun at the time.
But sometimes, you know, the casual observations that actually, years later, were really quite enforcing. There was a casual observation of a thing called an ERS-14, which is essentially a tanker truck with some shovels fitted on long arms on it. And it was a signature equipment for a chemical defence battalion. And quite a few years later, something identical, essentially, was an ERS-14, but it was seen in both in Iraq. And the concern, therefore, was that, of course, the Iraqis were getting ready to use chemical weapons. And the Americans were getting extremely excited about this. But, of course, one of the things Brixmas had seen them using this thing for was simply giving the troops in the field a warm shower, should they need a shower, to wash down. And we were able to say to the Americans, "Well, look, be very careful about identifying this as definitely chem or chem bio. It could be that they're simply using it as a shower facility." And of course, when you then look at the rest of the TONE and the Orbat side of it, you could see the numbers that were being used, and it was simply that
all they were doing was using it as a way of washing. And we were able to take some of the heat out of the chem bio situation for that particular part of the reactive boilers. So casual observations was just as important. Although, Mike, I remember being at the Rawbeck sidings just north of Potsdam one day, again with the same guys who were at the team that we got the ERA box, and we saw an ARS-14 filling up from a railway tanker, one of these massive railway tankers. I said to John, Joe Ross at the time, you know, we've got to come back and get a sample of this, you know, before this tanker leaves, because, you know, it was a high, it was a chemical weapons equipment, as you know, so it was high collection priority. Anyway, we wait until about 2 o'clock the next morning, crept back into the sidings, parked the vehicle about 100 meters away. John and I got off and climbed up the side of this. Oh, sorry. And I said, well, I'm going to need time to get a sample in. So I went back to the mission house for a coffee or something. We're on the local tour around Potsdam, so we could do that. And at the time, the advertisement on the telly was for Schweppes. Tonic water, and it was Schweppes, you know who. So the cynic in me, you know, said, okay, I'll take a Schweppes bottle with me. So I emptied it out, washed it out, made sure there's no cross contamination. And my 50 metres of paracord, we climbed up on the top of this vehicle in the dead of the night and lifted the lid, and of course it was being, you know, rusty, made an enormous sort of anyway. So John and I thought, and the first thing that hit us, of course, was the fumes from this thing. And you know, you talk about health and safety. You know, all we had was our RAF flying gloves, you know, our gloves assassin, our North Barnum ones, you know. And the first thing that hit us, so we turned our heads away, and I dropped my Schweppes bottle in, got other splash, brought it up, put a bit of rag in the top, took it back, and of course, then wound its way back to the UK, the diplomat bag, or however these things used to get back. And the intelligence community confirmed that it was trichloroethylene, okay, which certainly wasn't used for showers, okay, and it was one of the first, and we didn't know that the SOFs were using this as a decontaminant at the time, apparently. And the other thing they confirmed, of course, was that it was highly carcinogenic. And then, of course, a few years later, John went and died. And so the first thing it was at the time that Peter was writing the thing about you know, our bar for the GSM. And so, you know, how dangerous it was. And so I managed to contact the coroner of John's, because I was quite keen to find out what John died of. You know, because had he died of lung cancer or something like that, then, you know, it could have, you know... Not that I find it predict when I'm going to go, but, you know, I like to think about, you know. So anyway, I did all that, and luckily for me, they confirmed that John died of natural causes. So, but it just shows how the things, you know, go on with what we did then, and the risk we took, really, without even thinking about, really, our own health and safety, you know, just for the sake of other intelligence.
Dave, just just for the record, what was John's surname? What was his...
I guess he's dead now, so John Biles.
What else?
He was a bigger officer. He was the guy with me on the ERA box as well.
Okay.
John really went, so I can never always remember his face in the vehicle. And I don't know, there's so many swear words in about 1 second come out now from our poor ERA bombs out. But he's a great bloke, good guy. And, you know, he's sad with this, you know, vice chair.
Like that, you set me out to a big, massive, deep mind, open mind, fakes and samples. We took some back. I'll give you a pet. That was really cool.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Well, you have to ask yourself, why did Dave send you instead of himself? So I think one of the themes that's emerging in this discussion is how well prepared mission crews really were. And I'll give you an example of how much better we were than the Russians we were working against. Dave mentioned a railway sidings. And there was a famous railway sidings in the local area near Berlin called Satzkorn. Yeah. And it was well known as a place through which equipments would pass coming or going from the Potsdam garrison and the garrisons north of Berlin. So we always paid particular attention to that in the local. We go on a run through and so on. And it had no restrictions placed upon him. So one day, we came across the sidings, and then there were roads that ran either end, end to end. And not a big sidings, maybe half a dozen tracks and so on. And there were emission restriction signs. And if people don't know what those are, they're the I think, three or four language signs. There's one there that the Russians intended to prevent missions passing. In other words, they were stating that they didn't want you to go beyond those signs. There was something sensitive. Well, it was clearly of a temporary nature. So as things turned out, I thought, well, the hell with that. It's not been here before. It's not going to be here now. And I got out of the vehicle, knocked it over into the ditch, and we proceeded. Only to have the driver say to me, "Boss, there's an armored vehicle behind us." I thought, well, that's more interesting. And then, as we looked ahead, we saw another armored vehicle coming towards us. This is a single lane track. But then the wonderful point here is that because we knew the sighting so well, and in fact, only days before, we rehearsed leaving this track on an unapproved exit, in other words, a way down through a ditch into farmland that allowed us to escape such an ambush as this. So we used that, much to the frustration of the Russians. But a few days later, so a couple of days before we'd done a rehearsal, we escaped the trap. A couple of days later, I'm called by the chief, who asked me to accompany him on a protest trip to the Soviet External Relations Bureau. The Russians in Potsdam who managed the three Allied missions. And to my enormous embarrassment, I had to sit and interpret for the chief, who was receiving a protest about William, who had been photographed, and they gave us the pictures of a tour officer throwing away a mission restriction sign and then trespassing on sacred ground.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
So, you've got to be careful. Steve Harrison, who I think was due to be with us today, but for some reason isn't, has got his Stasi file, which is the file the East German secret police kept on mission members. And he revealed, I'm kind of looking to say the same thing, he revealed that, to his astonishment, the East Germans in particular had been much more capable of conducting covert surveillance than we imagined. And he's aware in his file of an occasion at one point where they were listening to the conversation in the vehicle and reported it quite accurately. So, being photographed pushing a mission aside is nothing. There's probably a great deal more. But I'm yet to obtain my file. I really should.
Well, I got mine. I got mine. Round up for it and got it. And I'm quite interested to find that the secret for the Stasi's view of Dave Butler was that I just liked eating ice cream all the time. been reading pornographic magazines.
Well, very accurate.
Well, whilst not entirely accurate, the pornographic magazines, of course, were to give terms, you know, Mike, would give to reggies and people like anybody, you know, because they would tell you anything if you gave them a pornographic magazine to read, because they never saw them anywhere, you know. But you're right. But what it did say, what it did tell to me, was that certainly they had the means of taking, you know, pretty accurate photographs of the, yeah, of you with long lenses from some distance off. And I remember with Folly Ward once, down at the Lexington later, at the ramp there, we were having a cup of coffee, and I looked out the right-hand window, and there was a guy lying by the side of the vehicle.
Yeah.
And I said to Colin behind me, "Hey, Colin, there's a guy." We our session at that time was that he was a deserter, because Colin just cracked the window and spoke to him in Russian, and the guy never moved. He was like a rabbit frozen in the headlights, you know. He never moved, he never said anything. And I said to him, "Yeah, we better move from here. One, he goes to run him over, and two, I don't like there being somebody being like that this close to the vehicle." So we went away, never came back, and he'd gone. And our assessment at the time was that he was a deserter who deserted his unit, and he was on the run. However, retrospectively, he could have been, KGB or Spetsnaz, you know, like Stephen experience, where I know they managed to take what they were saying in the vehicle.
I got two funny little stories, and I mean, we've spoken about the coffee breaks we always had. I mean, we would generally take a coffee break in an area where we could see something that might be of interest, a major vehicle intersection, we expected convoys to pass, or a rail junction or something. But you know, when you had your coffee, you'd wind the window down, you'd stop in a good open area so that you couldn't be surprised. And just occasionally, it never happened to me, I'm happy to say, something would occur, and, you know, for example, you'd see reggies appear, or you'd see a convoy start to come up the road. And, of course, the trouble was then, you throw your coffee, and you go and get on task. Well, there's a famous story, I'm not sure who it happened to, maybe somebody here can say. Kit goes to cry. The guy throws his coffee out when he thinks it's an open window, and it isn't. But the other funny thing, Dave mentioned ice cream, and the maps we carried, each of which, you know, people had to prepare for themselves, had no markings of any tactical significance. So should they fall into enemy hands, I use the term enemy in very commas, they gave nothing away about our knowledge of what happened and so on. But they did, for example, have, and it's been mentioned already, the Z-Plaza, Self-Plaza, place where you put your text. And they had ice cream shops of particular note, and a description of railway crossings. So, for example, whether they were lit or unlit, whether there were barriers or no barriers, and whether they were manned. So, I mean, all these were important when you were considering somewhere that you could sit for the evening, listening to tapes, having your dinner while you waited for a train to pass. But the symbol for an ice cream was, as you might imagine, a little cone. And on one occasion, a map fell into the hands of the Russians, and they were convinced that we were showing nuclear explosions. So you've got to be careful. Even the most innocent things can have a hidden meaning. Oh, by the way, the other thing that we marked religiously, well, two other things we marked religiously on the maps were porcelain shops for the Air Force members. And places, bakeries that sold particularly good Windbeutel, which is a very light shoe pastry with cream. Quite delicious. And I think these Germans did a lot of things very well, just not following people.
Mm-hmm. But I think I'd like to bring your story in at that point. The Mission House itself, you've seen lots of pictures over there. Neil's got every, and can't, Dave, you need to see this collection. It puts bricks me to shame, to be honest with you. And even down to the recorder, even down to the beeper. I kid you not, honestly. Anyway, the Mission House, it was, I can't remember how many bedrooms it was, but one of the mission, one of the duties of mission driver. Yeah, you were allowed to bring your family over. Okay. And on this occasion, you allowed another pass. So I brought my brother over on this particular occasion. And we would have our normal coffee and cake on the overlooking the lovely lake and everything else, overlooking Sicily and all. And we went to bed that night. My brother was in the back bedroom, my wife and I and the children, blah, blah, blah. And my brother come running in. He said, "Somebody's throwing teacups at my window." I said, "Don't be silly." I said, "You've got the East German police over the other, you know, they were literally facing the mission so they could book us in and out." Yeah, knew who was on tour at the time. I said, "No, don't be so silly." He said, "I'm serious." He said, "The cups that we were drinking out of, that literally they've come through the window." So I went out and basically what happened is, the East Germans, and they were ex-NVA, National Volksarmee people, they'd welded up the right-hand side of the Trabant and they'd hit the mission gate. Okay, escaped out the window, went into the mission house. Of course, the East Germans couldn't go in because it was deemed as Soviet property. I think I'm right in saying that. And basically they were, you know, when you've got your brother there who's not been exposed to anything like that at all, in the DDR, okay, behind the Iron Curtain, so to speak. And these three people were on their knees crying, and wanting sort of, you know, diplomatic immunity. Of course, they wasn't going to get it. And we had to phone the Soviet External Relations branch at the time. I think it was Captain Stropkin who came to actually detain these three individuals. And they were there on their knees crying. And they gave us as part and parcel, "Look, we've got all these documents." And they were, their low-level training manuals that they had for the National Volksarmee. Just comes to show how, a civvy being exposed to that incident. He never forgotten that.
Also, the mission house staff, I'm just going to pass the photograph around to you now. They were, you think I'm right, Corky, aren't they?
Corky, you know
that? Yeah, I think that most of them were Stasi or briefed by the Stasi, weren't they?
Well, Stasi partakers in the men, yeah.
Yeah, so they had
partakers. Well, there's a pair of women there.
These photos are coming around of the staff with some of us, and then Potsdam, the Sussi there. And the little, there's a lot of vehicle enthusiasts here, the little Volkswagen thing that Steve, Ked was driving the night that the wall came down. I've just found, Steve's not here actually. Oh, Steve Harris is not here. There's a picture here of a black and white one. That's Steve on the course when he was chasing me because we had to practice getting chased because our job was get away. Escape. So we used to come back with wings missing, headlights missing, they'd chop trees down to try and capture surround railway signs. If we went in after the French, then they were already annoyed like a load of bees in the eye because the French were ridiculous and used to have a barbecue or something stupid like that before. And then we'd come in and they'd think we were the saints or about because then they'd soon find out that we actually knew what we were doing. And so Steve Harrison was chasing me on the course, and that's a picture of him stuck in his little 432 there. He couldn't get through where my G wagon got through on the course at Ashford. It's a shame not here. I'll keep that and send that. Let's see.
I think some of the other thing worthy of note is the obviously squaddy humour. Yeah, Army and RAF got a little bit of humour now and again. Anyway, long story short, it was the first time in the mission house, and I don't know whether or not it was Mike it was Tim Townley actually. Bless him. And I was sort of having a cup of coffee. And a cake or whatever it was. And was that flower just yours? And Tim would say, "All the flowers are booked." And I was expecting all these flowers to be turning direction, all these tulips to be listening in to you. And it was a well-known fact as well. I think I'm right in saying this, Corky, that that it was booked. It was heavily booked, the mission house. And obviously, those marital business that goes on behind closed doors, you have to be very, very careful what you said, what you did, knowing full well it would have been not probably on film, but certainly on tape. Yeah, well.
But Bobby was, pretty much eyes across the board. He's dead after the mission. Five days after the mission. And one of the wee job that one was to visit the Czech Republic and help to keep off a particular building there. And we took our wives along, myself and the guy that went, And funny, like, of course, we've been used to bugging at the various jobs that we've had over the years. But this other poor chap, his wife was picked up completely by a source. And at one point, we went into the control room for the building. And of course, there's all the CCTV cameras up. And pointed out to him that this is the group that we're speaking in tonight. And they're all still alive. And my own wife, God bless her soul now, she's long dead. Her attitude was, well, let's go on a decent show for them. Well, my companion, Wayne, was absolutely horrified. I spent the whole night lying on top of the bed.
So, just while we're talking on the subject of bunny and beaconing and so on, I don't know whether it's been mentioned already, but it would have occurred to people eventually that one good way of keeping track of the mission vehicles would be to put a beacon on them, so that you could track them. And for that reason, every time, I think I'm right in saying, and the guys can confirm this, right, every time the vehicles came back into the mission, and back into West Berlin, part of the post-tour inspection was a very detailed examination of the undersides and all the various voids to make sure that we had not been beaconed. Because that clearly would have made the Russians' job much, much simpler. And, you know, that said, I experienced a tour, again in the local area, on one occasion, overnight, where we being given a hint that there were some pretty sensitive equipments coming into Saskatoon on the local sidings for unloading. And try as we might, we could not get close to the sidings without picking up some sort of tuck tail. And these were not East German vehicles. These were Russian vehicles. They were Ladas, and they had Russian military plates on them. And we did our level best to shake them. And succeeded on a couple of occasions, only to find an hour or so later that they were back behind us again. And, you know, we made a special report on that particular issue, and that there was never any conclusion reached, but it was the firm opinion of all three members of the crew, given the nature of the techniques we'd used to throw a tail, including, you know, no lights, all the rest, and off-road. The fact that they kept picking us up suggested extremely strongly that they had another means of finding us. And we've never really got to the bottom of that. There was never any feedback from the authorities on that particular issue. But just going back to touring, and there are a couple of interesting little things that might not have come up yet. Things that told you there was equipment around. One of them was tracking. And when I say tracking, what I mean is armoured vehicles, when they pass down an asphalt roadway, or tarmac roadway, as you say in Europe, they leave a very distinct track mark. I mean, anybody who's been around construction will have seen bulldozers do the same. So tracking was always exciting. There was a particular smell to the diesel fuel that the Russian vehicles used. Yeah. And you would be driving down a road, and all of a sudden, all three of you would look at one another and say, oh, soft fuel, soft gas. And you know, that again would tell you that either something had passed just in front of you or just gone by. Well, it probably hadn't got by because you'd have seen it. And I'm trying to think, there was a third thing. Oh, yes. Talking about the NVA, the National Folk Army, and their national service period, one of the things we would see all the time when we were following vehicles, you know, just one or two vehicles with troops in the back, a lot of these Germans, we have a roll of paper on which there were segments marked. And these tapes were made when they started their national service, with a date for each of the days of national service. And they'd tear one off every day, and as they got towards the end, they would very proudly show you the sort of tail end of the tape, indicating with a broad smile on their face that they were coming to the end of their service. So just little things that stick in your mind.
There's a couple of pictures just going around now that you just mentioned when they went to an NVA and they changed from the National Volks Army, which are a really professional army and really much more slicker at trying to catch us and spotting and chasing us off quicker than the Soviets. They were demoralized. They were getting bullied. the Sox were demoralized, getting bullied. And some of the pictures that are coming around, you can see them doing PT in the clothes that they actually wear all day long. They're not like us, we go and get shorts and t-shirts on. They're doing PT, pulling themselves up on bars and things on those pictures that are coming around now. So they weren't treated very well. But the pictures that are coming around now has got the NBA with a berry, like we call it, a helicopter pack. And when you've got a brand new berry and you can't shape it, it's all flat. It was the first day he wore this berry and he had his new Bundeswehr uniform on. At one of the local camps, and we just went up to the gate and just chatted to him, said, "Oh, you put your new uniform on, that's good, can we get a picture on that?" And so you could see him there and saying, what do you think? And he's like, wasn't looking very much forward to it. Plus, you have to remember the East Germans as well only got 2-1, didn't they? When we were changing black market money, we were getting 8 or 9-1 when we went there. So we'd buy different things, like called it hoovering. Actually, I wasn't a fan of hoovering. So they'd all be queuing up outside the shop. We could go to the front because we were privileged in some kind of way. I collected the Matryoshka dogs you see over there. That's a tenner, the big one. It's faded on the outside, brand new on the inside. And that was my thing for my daughter. Some of the people collected Carl Zeiss binoculars, a pottery, Meissen pottery, didn't it?
Yeah.
They all collected cotton, crystal.
Yeah.
So everybody had something that they could do. When it wasn't busy, it wasn't a swan. But in between tours, you know, it would be like, there's a bonus if you could do a bit of cultural stuff if there was nothing happening. So it also gave the enemy the thing that, they're just going around having ice creams and cakes and buying things, aren't they? Not really.
It was actually as bad as you read,
living in the DDR.
One of the things that driver used to have to do is first thing in the morning, off 5-6 o'clock, is go to the bakery. And you'd park your vehicle on double yellows, of course, no parking, if there was such a thing. And there'd be 30, 40 people waiting for bread. I mean, you got to, you know, this is in the sort of late 80s. And you did sometimes, you know, they looked down on you as though, you know, got new money, got no this. I mean, meat was luxury. You know, if you see 20, 30, 40, 50 people waiting outside butchers, and you just go out there. One of the things that we used to have, and I remember because I'd never seen a black orange in all my life until I got, there used to be the Soviet rations. Yeah, part of the agreement was that we would provide the Soviets with rations and the Soviets would provide us with rations. But because we had all our rations came from West Berlin, of course, yeah, all the rations that were bought over from the Russians. I've never seen fruit like it in my life. Yeah. I mean, they were black oranges. And it was Tony Hoare. I'm sure he wouldn't mind me sharing his name, but he was the warrant officer. And he got a typical Yorkshire accent and
dry sense of humor.
Bloody hell, not that again. In fact, when the East Germans broke into the compound, the first thing it came down, he went, bloody. Not another one. And, you know, that was just Tony. But, yeah.
Well, we used to get fresh rations delivered because of the corridor thing. It was still going. So I could get the fresh rations delivered to your door. So it comes in a basket and so you could order it. But when you were a duty driver, like Kev was saying there, we had to chop the cow up. I don't know how to chop the cow up. So I don't know what the best state is or the worst. So all you'd get
for the castle.
Well, Wayne Fury, a guy called Wayne, knew how to chop it up, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Because he knew what battles to say. We never got that. He got that.
Me either.
So we just chopped it up. You just get it and you just go, what are you going to do with that? And you just end up boiling it. Helps. There's nothing else you could do. But that was one of the things that they had to do for us. But I'm sure they got better rations from the Nazi in Bundo where Soxness were.
Right. Well, we've been going as long as almost a Bricksmiths tour. but I think it would be great, we could just say thank you to all of our guests today for sharing these incredible stories. It's been amazing. I have learned so much today. I've been talking to you guys for years, but there was stuff with it that I'd never heard. So absolutely fascinating, and thank you. Sure, if you do have any other questions, some of these guys are still going to be around and are keen to show off their memorabilia over there. Thank you.
Thanks for inviting us. Yeah, it's been good.
Thank you. Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. If you'd like to help the project, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.